Imagine writing a book that was 14 years in the making. That was the case for my next guest, Todd Finkel. He's the author of Warren Buffett, Investor and Entrepreneur. And I read it in about three sittings. So the book flows nicely, has great stories in it. And the sections on Charlie Munger and behavioral investing, well, they are exceptional. The topic is Warren Buffett, my guest, Todd Finkel. Oh, I'm Mark Gandy, and this is CFO Bookshelf. I listen to every show after the production has been wrapped up, and I noticed that I mentioned Adam Mead during the conversation, but I never said who he is. So Adam has been a prior guest. His book is an encyclopedia of every Buffett investment from day one. So when you hear his name pop up in about 30 or so minutes, you'll have some context. Again, my guest is Todd Finkel. He's a professor of entrepreneurship at Gonzaga. And what an enjoyable person to chat with. Very conversational, speaks with a smile, and I wish we could have just kept talking more and more. I start out this conversation by being transparent with Todd when I first saw the title of his book. Your book came out and I'm thinking, okay, here's another book on Warren Buffett. And I'll be transparent, Todd, I did not read it right away. Well, because you're on LinkedIn, and I keep seeing your face over and over, and I see the book being mentioned. It's like, I need to read this. So my first impression was another book on Buffett. Well, then I read page one in the introduction. Guess what it says? You're never going to believe what's in the first few pages, Todd, of this book, this fun book. It says that the author went to school with Warren's children. He grew up in Nebraska, Omaha, Nebraska. What a cool story. What a great way for the author to get a start. It's like, okay, I'm all in. I was hooked right from the very beginning. Isn't that cool?
That was one of the major reasons why I wrote the book, is because I grew up with a family in Omaha and went to school with Pete and used to eat lunch with them every day in the cafeteria.
Listen to you. You can call him Pete.
That's what we called him, Pete.
What were these children like? I get the idea that, and I think you even mentioned this about him, they didn't know what their dad was loaded.
Well, back then, they didn't even realize that he was, you know, nobody knew that his dad was Warren Buffett. Nobody talked about it at the lunch table. Berkshire Hathaway's stock price was $69. Back then, and what is it now? Like over 500,000?
Yes.
So, Pete used to wear a baseball cap and ripped up jeans, and he was the most humble, kind of quiet and reserved guy, not outgoing, more of an introvert, but a really nice guy, very artsy, into photography and into music. And eventually, you know, he went to Stanford after high school and dropped out after a semester because his grandfather left him some money, all the kids' money. And he had this luxury of having that money. And his Warren said he could do whatever you want to do. So he dropped out and he just focused on music. And he lived on that money and just focused on music. And I think he won a Grammy eventually.
And I think you mentioned that in the book, Todd. One other question before we move on. When you were a youngster, did you ever run into Warren or meet him? Or was it even a big deal back then to try to meet him?
You know, the thing when I was younger, the thing was stories that you would hear, more like legendary stories about people that invested with him. Really early. And, the cool thing about Omaha, as a kid, I didn't really like it because there really wasn't much to do there. And this is, pre Warren Buffett, but post Warren Buffett, after he got rolling, you know, all these people moved to Omaha and all this construction happened in Omaha. And it's really a happening place now. The healthcare facilities there in Omaha are amazing. So, I mean, if you're ever in Omaha, you go to the shareholder meeting, drive around. There's a healthcare area kind of in Midtown, and there's so much going on there. It's like the number one hospital in the country for liver transplants.
It's remarkable.
Who would have known in Omaha?
I couldn't help but think, reading the chapter on Charlie Munger, you have a chapter fully dedicated to Charlie, and plus he's mentioned throughout the book. There are numerous quotes. I mean, how do you write a book about Warren Buffett and Charlie's not popping up from time to time, but you have a whole chapter. Todd, are you going to be updating the book soon because of his passing, or are you going to wait still?
I've actually got a meeting with Mac Sykes. I don't know if you know him. He's at Gabelli Funds, and we have a little conference, usually about 500 people attend it the day before the shareholder meeting, and there's a panel. Adam Mead is going to be on the panel and a couple other authors. And we're going to talk about Charlie, and, you know, and I guarantee you the way cause Susie Buffett, who I interviewed for the book too, she puts together a movie before the shareholder meeting. It's an hour long movie. And I'll guarantee you this year, you don't want to miss that movie because it'll be a highlight of Charlie Munger and all the women he's gotten, because the movies usually are Charlie ending up with a woman at the end, a different woman. They always want Charlie. So I bet it'll be a highlight of that, all the women Charlie's gotten throughout his life.
Hey, before we get into the book, I want to give you one more compliment. In my opinion, I read a lot of nonfiction. To me, the mark of a good nonfiction book is when the reader stops and they look up something from the book. So for example, we're going to talk about one of my favorite stories in the book, the encounter with Lorimer Davy Davidson. Well, I don't know if you've seen this. There is a video on the Warren Buffett website. It's in the archives section. There's a video about 7 or 8 minutes of Warren talking about his interview with Davy Davidson. It is outstanding. The other thing you caused me to do was Geico. Now, I know about the original investment in Geico, but I wanted to learn more about Geico. So I found a white paper. There's no book on just the history of Geico. So you got me there. And then one last thing, we were just talking about Charlie Munger. So you mentioned the psychology of human misjudgment. Well, guess what? I looked it up, and there's a 50-page PDF where Charlie went back and updated that speech. And I didn't know this. He was talking about behavioral finance even before that was a term.
Right. And so Charlie was behavioral finance.
Exactly. So I just wanted to compliment you because you caused me to stop throughout the book and go down not rabbit trails, but to read more. And I credit you for triggering this curiosity. So again, just very, very well done on this book.
I appreciate that. Actually, I love Charlie so much that I wrote 2 chapters on Charlie, and Columbia, the publisher, told me you get knock one of them out or combine them together. So I had to combine both, but I love Charlie so much. I had all this material. I probably could have written a book on Charlie. I had all this material on him. And, but you can learn so much from him. Just listening to him on YouTube, he's got some speeches, and you can learn so much.
So Warren Buffett, the man, and I don't want to steal your thunder, but there are just a few things that popped out. Again, some of these are reminders, some of these things I'd forgot about, but this guy is unreal. It's almost like, how does this person even exist? Are you still amazed? I mean, you've written about him, you know him. words cannot describe the kind of person he is.
I think what's special about Warren is he's so incredibly intelligent, but yet he has a very high IQ and EQ. So he knows how to deal with people really well, and he's very humble. He's got these characteristics that you would not think that somebody of his stature would have, you know, and that's what makes him Warren Buffett. People go to him for advice. But whenever a tragedy happens in the United States, or, you know, like the Great Recession, you know, everybody was listening to every word he had to say, and he was on CNBC. And then with COVID, who did they go to? Warren Buffett, you know, and again, everybody was asking him, what do we do? And he said, don't do anything. And he was right.
I'm impressed with his lifestyle. He still lives in the same house that he bought, gosh, how many years ago? And I think of all the people who could just drive by, the gawkers. Oh, that's where Warren
Buffett. Including us.
he can live anywhere. He can afford anything, but he still lives in that same house. I think you mentioned, I don't remember the page number, what chapter, but he had this older car, and I think his daughter made him sell it, but he still has an old car. He gives away all this money. He does not want his name, according to you in the book, doesn't want his name on the building. Yep. So I just appreciate the humility, and it's like he respects and reveres money, even though he knows how to earn it.
The thing is that when you drive around Omaha and you see these new buildings and stuff, and you got to think, I wonder if Warren put money into that, right? Because his name's not on the building.
Right.
And, you know, a new concert hall or a new theater, but a lot of people that made a lot of money with him also invested money into Omaha, like a brand new business school at the university there in Omaha. There's a guy, Mammal is the guy's name. He made a lot of money with Warren. I can go on and on with that.
It just, his persona, just a breath of fresh air. I can't think of a better word than just decency. Decency, common sense. You mentioned his cognitive capabilities. I want to bring something up that you elevated for me in the book. You mentioned the best $100 he ever spent. What was that, Todd?
The best $100 Warren ever spent was on a Dale Carnegie course. And that's the only thing he had, only diploma he has up in his office. And he got a degree from Columbia, a graduate degree, and an undergrad from the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, while he was managing 50 people who were delivering papers underneath him. He was doing that full time while he was going to school full time. And he graduated undergrad at 19. And I think he graduated at Columbia at 21. And then he tried to go work for Benjamin Graham. He studied under Benjamin Graham, and Benjamin Graham rejected him. He said he would go work for Benjamin Graham on Wall Street. Benjamin Graham had a hedge fund, Graham Newman. And he said, you're undervaluing yourself, Warren. go find somewhere where somebody's going to pay you. And he ended up going back to Omaha, and he worked for his father. His father had a stock brokerage. So he went back there for like 4 years, and he was bugging. One of the biggest things that I learned from all my dealings with Warren Buffett is he loves people that are very persistent. And Warren, if you go back and look at his own life, he was very persistent. And that was one of the keys to his success. And he kept on bothering Benjamin Graham, you know, to get a job at his firm and sending him, you know, potential deals and things like that. And eventually Benjamin Graham hired him after about 4 years. And Warren went to work on Wall Street for a couple of years and became a millionaire by the time he was 25.
On that $100, the best $100 ever spent. Can I read a quote from the book? Warren says, I would recommend that you improve your oral and written communication skills. This will improve your pay by at least 50%. The kids that you teach, you are a professor of entrepreneurship. Do your kids believe that, or do they think, oh, everyone says that? Do they really believe this is a fact?
Well, when you hear Warren Buffett tell you that in person, I'll guarantee you those kids believe it. But I also tell all my students that. Every semester I tell my students that. You've got to be able to communicate your ideas, you know, both orally and written. And Warren's absolutely correct. You can't just sit there and not say anything.
One thing I wish people, even like Warren Buffett, and maybe he does, improve your communication skills. That almost sounds like a weasel word. We use it so much, we become numb to it. A couple of minutes ago, Todd used the word to describe Warren Buffett as high EIQ. So for example, part of the communication skills needs to be knowing how to read people.
Exactly.
Communicate with different types of personalities, knowing how to work a room, work a negotiation. Those are all things that he's mastered over the years, and he'd probably still say, I'm still working on it. But I would just wish that people, when they talk about improving your communication skills, add to that definition. But again, I appreciate it because I'd forgotten the story about the $100. Hey, speaking of persistence, I want you to retell another story. It's one of my favorite stories in the book. And again, it took persistence. It's the meeting with Lorimer Davy Davidson. Could you retell the story again, Todd?
So Warren's studying under Benjamin Graham at Columbia University, getting his master's degree. And Benjamin Graham said he was the best student he's ever had. And while Benjamin Graham was teaching at Columbia, and he would give the money he made at Columbia back to them, he did it for free. That's what's amazing about Benjamin Graham. And that's Buffett's hero. He owned, I believe it was 50% of Geico. And he was on the board of directors, and he would talk about it in class. And so here's Warren listening to him talk about Geico and going on and on about it. So what does Warren do? Warren, I believe he took a train down to Washington, D.C. on a Saturday, and he went to Geico and he knocked on the door because you can't get in. It was locked. And there was a security guard there, and he was trying to, you know, get in and talk to somebody. There was only one guy that was there from Geico, Davidson, and the guy let him in, and he went upstairs and he talked to Davidson, convinced him to talk to Davidson, or convinced Davidson to talk to him. And he did that for 5 hours. They talked for 5 hours. And Warren said, this is one of my favorite things too, Mark. Warren said, I learned more in those 5 hours than I did in all of the college classes in my life. 5 hours. Is that amazing?
I was blown away. I was so taken back. Davy Davidson doesn't know this kid from Matt. I mean, who is this guy? I know it's a different era. It's a Saturday, by the way, but you just said 5 hours. Who does that? And that story meant a lot to me, and I'd forgotten about it. I'm trying to remember if I even remembered the story. Again, it's a fantastic story.
Persistence, creativity, thinking outside of the box, being aggressive and assertive, and again, communication. Going back to that, his ability to communicate and get in the door. Yeah, it's just amazing.
The subtitle of the book is Entrepreneur and Investor. Now, this is opinion. Now, people who follow Buffett and who are students, acolytes of Warren Buffett, they may think Well, this is nothing new, Mark, but you reminded me that Warren Buffett is as much entrepreneur as he is an investor. In fact, he may be entrepreneur first, investor second. Maybe, because he's pulled off some incredible acquisitions. So maybe, again, that's debatable. But you have some really good definitions of entrepreneurship. Now, I already have a couple of quotes that I want to read, but you want to share how you view entrepreneurship?
So I've been teaching entrepreneurship for 34 years. I'm so old, Mark.
You're young.
There were only two PhD programs offering a PhD in entrepreneurship when I went to school. So I'm kind of a pioneer in the field of entrepreneurship. There are like over 60 different definitions, but my definition really is about seeking opportunity, you know, and it's a mindset, a way of thinking, creative, calculated risk-taking, things of that nature. And if you go back and you look at Warren became an entrepreneur at 4 years old, and he was selling lemonade on his neighbor's driveway. And then he was a serial entrepreneur, you know, before he was 10 years old, doing all these things, going door to door during the Depression and selling gum and Coke. And then he was selling popcorn and peanuts at ball games. And he got his first investment in the stock market at age 11. And he lost money initially on that. And then he watched it go up about $3 from where he bought it. It was City Services. And he quickly traded it and cashed out. And then he watched it go to 200. It was at like 33.
He didn't want his sister to lose money.
Yeah. And that was his first investment mistake. And he realized that. And he emphasizes the importance of patience throughout the book and you know, his career, the importance of that. But back to entrepreneurship, I mean, he's done so many entrepreneurial things in his life, and he continued to do those in college. And then he started his own investment partnership, seven of them, you know, and he's definitely an entrepreneur. There's no doubt about it. Now, some people say, oh, he's not an entrepreneur. You know, he's an investor. What are you talking about, Todd? And I'm thinking to myself, okay, you know, maybe later you could say that sort of, but he's even entrepreneurial in the sense that he's looking for deals. He's looking for opportunities, being creative, and how he structures those deals. Like during the Great Recession, he did all these deals with companies, like Goldman Sachs, and he made billions structuring deals with them. And if that's not entrepreneurial, I don't know what is.
I would say that Apple, that's a clear-cut investment, right? But See's Candy, what's the first thing that him and Charlie do? Now, I don't know if this is more Charlie or if it is both, but right after they buy, one of the first things they do is they raise prices. That's not an investing decision. That's an entrepreneurial decision. Nebraska Furniture Mart, they make some changes. To me, that's entrepreneurialism. And that's why I'm thinking he is just as much entrepreneur as he is investor. Now, you did not get too much into the relationship with Kay Graham. I've read Kay Graham's memoir, which is phenomenal. It's one of the best memoirs I've ever read. Him stepping in and just being a mentor to her and her son, that's entrepreneurship. So, no, yeah. We're on the same page. He is as much entrepreneur as he is investor. And at times, maybe more so. Maybe other times he's more investor.
Exactly. Yeah. And even, you know, most recently is his investments in Japan, those five trading companies. That just came out of nowhere. And how he structured that, with debt from the yen that was like a 0.5% debt through selling bonds to structure that acquisition. That's entrepreneurial.
Do you mind if I quickly read two of your quotes on entrepreneurship? I think these are excellent. They're simple. They are concise, and I can wrap my arms around them. You say that entrepreneurs are hungry. This is great, sir. The refrigerator is empty. It's always empty. Now, I added that part. I cannot teach students how to be hungry. Good one. They either possess that quality or they don't. They're either hungry or they're not. Hunger, hunger, hunger.
Yep.
Do we get that right?
So, yeah, on the first day of class of the semester, my entrepreneurship class, that's what I talk about. And I put this picture of a refrigerator on the board, and I ask my students what it is, and most of them don't know what it is because my drawings are terrible. And then I open it up. I go, okay, what's in the refrigerator? And nobody knows. And I go, okay, nothing's in the refrigerator. I go, and that's what entrepreneurs are. They're hungry. They don't have anything to eat. There's nothing in their refrigerator. And I can't teach you that. And I do this like within the first 5 minutes of class. And I'm looking around at everybody, and the true entrepreneurs are smiling and they're excited. And you can tell that they're in the right place. And most of entrepreneurs are very rare, by the way. So there's not a lot of them that are doing that.
Right.
Maybe two or three. But everybody else is kind of, they have their mouth open, like, oh, am I in the right place? You know, and, but I love that. I love doing that every semester, the first thing. I know who the entrepreneurs are within the first couple minutes.
I bet you can. I want to read one more quote. It's one of my favorite quotes in the book. This is from Charlie, by the way. Like, you would have known that without me saying it. But he says, in my whole life, I've known no wise people who didn't read all the time. None. Zero. You'd be amazed at how much Warren reads and how much I read. My children laugh at me. They think I'm a book with a couple of legs sticking out. Now, parenthetically, I skipped over this, but parenthetically, he says, it's not just any reading. It's a broad subject matter area. So not just finance, not just business books, but I'm assuming everything. I love that quote. And I'm assuming you are a reader, right?
Nothing compared to Charlie and Warren, not at 500 pages a day. But I don't think Warren does 500 pages a day.
I was going to say, what does that mean? I've read that before. What does that mean? Is it reports, annual reports?
Yeah.
Is it SEC documents?
You know, and the newspaper. He reads like 7 newspapers every day.
It's a lot of content.
Sometimes he'll do that even before he comes down to work.
That's again, I find that remarkable. How do you take what he's saying and communicate that to the students you're teaching? There are some students, they don't want to read. Now, what I tell younger people is it's okay if you don't read, but you've got to find a way to feed the mind. So do you like podcasts? Hey, if there's a certain show on Netflix, watch it, because you're going to be watching through your personal lens. So I'm just curious, as a professor, how do you take what they are doing and how do you translate that to them, that they need to be lifelong learners?
My philosophy has been that I try and get them to focus on what they're passionate about. So I kind of leave it open, and I'm not trying to tell everybody to do. In entrepreneurship, everybody's so different. So I try and give them the freedom and the flexibility to do what they're passionate about and what they're good at. Yeah, you know, I give them the flexibility to fail too, and say it's okay to fail, because a lot of entrepreneurs do that. But And I have an advisory board of 70 people from all over the world. So the students have access to all these different people that will be there to help them, and they judge competitions and work with them and mentor them. And it's great. I love it. Very entrepreneurial the way I teach.
Now, there's something that needs to be added, and I just find this as fascinating as this quote. In the book, you talk about no fancy formulas, no complex financial modeling, no algorithms of any kind. I think when it comes to discounted cash flow analysis, which you give an example in the book, you made the comment that he maybe does the DCF in his head. That blows me away. I do a ton of financial modeling. I use some interesting pieces of software to just help and augment the modeling process. I can't relate to them not doing any modeling of any kind. Does that surprise you?
Well, Charlie said he's never seen him use the DCF.
But you know no, he does. But you know he does, right? Hagstrom. What's Hagstrom's?
He's told me. I asked him at lunch because I went out to lunch with him three times, and the first question I had for Warren was, "How do you value a company?" To me, that was the hardest part. Even after writing the book, you know, he goes the discounted cash flow. That was it.
I'm drawing a blank on his first name, Hagstrom. Hagstrom.
Robert Hagstrom.
I've read many of his books, and that's where I first learned how he, you know, goes about his investing approach. And I would just think that Warren, he's got to have. I mean, that's pretty hard to do in your head. And by the way, I teased you yesterday in a newsletter that you said that you think he does it in his head, and it's like, that's a pretty smart guy if you can do discounted cash flow analysis in your head. That's pretty impressive. But
either that or the investment is so good there is no need to do that. It just
good point
blows off the page.
Good point. One last thing on his investment approach. Again, any student of Buffett knows I call it the big three. The big three. Now, this is my big three. I think there may be some others, but the moat. By the way, I know he calls it durable competitive advantage. Did he come up with the term moat, or did someone else attribute moat to his concept? Yeah,
I don't know who the originator of that is, but
again, that's brilliant. I love that. That moat is so vivid in my mind. We already mentioned pricing power. We did it C's candy. And then he wants a strong and also an ethical management team. You've been around, Warren. You've been at the annual meetings. Is there anything else that sticks out from his investment approach?
His circle of competence. You know, that's one of the most important things. You know, you want to go into an area that you're familiar with or the industry and the management team and the moat, the qualitative aspects, and then you get into the quantitative aspects and what he looks for as well.
And by the way, speaking of the qualitative aspects, that didn't come until later, right?
I think so, yeah.
Because you point that out that it wasn't just buying these cheap stocks. You know, Charlie clarified that. I think, was it Philip Fisher? Am I getting the names right? I think he had a big impact on his thinking. I will say this, and I'm not going to go through every name. I liked it that you gave us just a brief rundown of all the investments that did not pan out. So even though he's got this great investment approach, he is far from perfect.
Yeah.
I mean, and I'm still... When I finished the book, I was still, how did he still decide to go into the airline industry? He'd already been bitten in the behind once, so he does it again. So he is flawed, right?
Yep. You know, one of the biggest things, you asked me why write another book on Buffett. that chapter was one of the reasons why, is because I've never seen a chapter on his investment mistakes. And also never really seen an in-depth chapter on behavioral finance. So I added that as a chapter, and I applied the behavioral finance biases that Buffett did
right
to his mistakes. And I discussed that in the mistake chapter. So I love the behavioral finance chapter. That's probably my favorite chapter, because as Charlie always said at the annual meetings, that's the most important thing. And Warren agreed with him, is your temperament.
I was going to say, Todd, I just finished a book on inattentional blindness. And as I was going through your list, and I'm thinking he had some inattentional blindness in some of these investment decisions. Well, in the time we have left, can we hit Berkshire Hathaway real quickly? I have just a couple of questions here. By the way, this is great. Again, your book is just such a treat. It's a fun, quick read. Did you know I read it, and I want to say in 3 sittings? It's like I didn't want to stop. And it's just, it flows very, very nicely. Here's the thing I still don't get. And I first observed this in a 60 Minutes interview long time ago, and they were actually in his office. The hallways were narrow, and by the way, you mentioned that in the book, but only 25 employees, and that's the count in your book. I don't get it. How do you have this large financial organization, which is almost like a hedge fund? How do you do it with 25 people when there are other organizations like them that may have 5 times, 10 times that amount? Does that still astound you? 25 people.
And one secretary. That's what I can't believe. And what does he have? Like 365,000 employees?
I was going to say it's not 400,000. It's in the 300,000s, yes. Yeah.
And 62 companies, private companies, and I think I'll tell you what I think on that. I think, again, let's go back to Warren being an entrepreneur.
Right.
All right. So to get into the head of an entrepreneur, entrepreneurs don't like managing people.
Right.
They have a hard time managing people. They expect a lot out of people. That's why they have a hard time managing people. So I'm thinking Warren, you know, he doesn't want to get into the whole HR thing and dealing with people. He wants to kind of outsource that to the people, to the companies, to the managers of the companies, and have them do that, and then have them send reports to him however often. I remember reading something that he said the other day that he hadn't talked to this company in like 10 years. I just don't think that he wants to get involved in that. He learned that from Tom Murphy. I don't know if you know who Tom Murphy is, but he was one of Warren's, he was on the board of directors of Berkshire, and he was one of Warren's mentors. And he was very successful with Capital Cities, ABC. And he learned a lot of things from Tom Murphy about management, about being frugal, you know, and decentralization, which is what Warren does, if you want to call a name to what he does. And yeah, and acquisitions. He has a philosophy about acquiring companies as well. And no hostile takeovers. Warren's never done that. And, you know, he'll put a price down on a company if he wants to buy it. And if they don't like it, he'll walk.
One of my favorite stories. So there, we've already mentioned my first favorite story in the book. There was another favorite story, and it's in the context of Berkshire Hathaway. I want to say this happened in 2006, 2007. There's this $1 million wager. Do you know what I'm talking about? Do you remember this from the book?
Oh, yeah. I was there.
Oh, you were there. I love this story. I did not remember it. Can you share the story?
You know, I went to all these shareholder meetings up until like the last 14 excluding COVID, when COVID was happening, I was watching it live on stream. But one shareholder meeting, Doug Cass was the name of the guy. He's more of a kind of a short the market guy. He's a hedge fund guy. And him and Warren went into a deal that he had a fund of funds, like five different hedge funds.
Right.
And he said that they would outperform the S&P 500 over a 10-year period. And Warren bet a million. They both bet, you know, $1 million, and they put it into some fund so it would increase money over the 10 years. And Warren said the S&P would outperform them. And every year at the meeting, he would put up how the S&P was doing versus the hedge funds. And every year they'd be beating the hedge funds, and the whole crowd, you got to remember, there's like 40,000 people there. The whole crowd would be just screaming with laughter. And every year it gets stronger and stronger until the final year. And it just blew away the hedge funds. I can't remember exactly what the percentages were,
but it was significant. It was.
Oh, yeah.
Radically.
It wasn't even remotely close.
No, not at all. Not at all. Again, great story. And it just goes to show, if you're going to invest in individual equities, make sure you know what you're doing and that you can devote a lot of time to those investments. Nothing wrong with the index fund. Do you, and I'm sure you teach that, right?
Yeah, I own some stock, but the majority of my money is in the S&P 500.
One more comment on Berkshire Hathaway. I'm thinking, how do I introduce Adam Mead into this and give him a shout out? Because we interviewed him, I want to say about 2 years ago. And great guy, by the way, which you.
Oh, know. Yeah, he's wonderful.
He's an outstanding person. And guess what? You'll be shocked, Todd, when I tell you this. Did you know that Adam is in the book? And I'm being funny yeah. here. But it was in the context of, should Berkshire Hathaway issue a dividend? Now, they're doing share buybacks, and Adam thinks they should issue a dividend. This may be unfair, because you're the writer. You're not editorializing. You're just writing. You're sharing history. You're sharing anecdotes, stories, great stories. But do I have permission to ask you, should they issue a dividend?
Well, they're not going to be doing it when Warren's alive. I can guarantee you that. Now, will they issue a dividend after he passes away? That would be up to the board, right?
Right.
And so who's on the board? Howie, who's Howard Buffett,
right,
will be the chairman of the board. Susie is now on the board, right. Susie Buffett. And they hired two guys on there, Chris Davis, who's a hedge fund guy, and he's a pretty famous guy. And they put a local guy from Omaha on there as well, along with some of the other people that were already on there. It would be tough for them to give a dividend, but I think it depends on how they're performing, how the Ted Weschler and Todd Coombs are performing and the stock is performing. If they're not performing up to how Buffett did, then the people make it anxious and want a dividend.
Good point.
So I wouldn't put anything out to pasture.
Do you feel like Berkshire Hathaway is going to stand the test of time once Warren's no longer with us?
Oh, yeah. Berkshire will be fine. Make it a down 5%, 10% when he passes away, but that will probably be a good time to buy. That's my guess.
Plug the heck out of anything that you want.
Here's my book. That took me 14 years of work to go ahead and write the book.
Oh, it did take you 14 years.
14 years, 9 years of research and, you know, 6 trips to go visit Warren and 14 trips to the shareholder meeting. And then after 9 years, I had all this primary research. I finally just said, I think I might be able to write a book on Warren Buffett. you know, and I was always very hesitant because there are already a lot of books that were out there, but I had enough material where I thought I was pretty sure that I could break new ground and find some interesting things that people would want to learn about. And my other book is more on entrepreneurship and some of the famous entrepreneurs like the Google guys, Steve Jobs. I've got a couple of case studies about him. And Warren, I got a case study about him. And the Virgin Atlantic guy, what's his name? Richard Branson. So I've written, before I did the Buffett book, I wrote all these case studies and all these famous entrepreneurs to try and learn about them and try and get in their heads and see, you know, what motivates them? What did they do? What were their keys to success? How can we learn from them? And I have my students, you know, get that book every semester and we go through some of those stories. The Google story is a really interesting story. And Warren passed on Google at their IPO. That was another one of his major blunders.
His misses and Microsoft as well. I think he stated, and this goes back to his personality, his decency. I think he was afraid that he might be thought of insider trading because of his relationship with Bill Gates, but he missed on Microsoft. But since Apple, that tide's starting to change. You mentioned the investment in Snowflake, good for them. That's turned out to be a home run, I believe.
Yeah. Last I saw it was up today.
Well, we ask every guest what some of their favorite books are.
I like Hagstrom, Robert Hagstrom. You mentioned him before. I would recommend people, if you really want to learn about Warren Buffett from the financial perspective, I think that he would be the guy, the Warren Buffett way. That would be the book for you
to read. Really like that book. To me, that's the starting point. I have a couple of
that one, and Snowball's a good one.
It is a good one.
You know, and that's more soft oriented, you know, about, you know, his life overall. And she had the inside over a 5-year period. She wrote the book and she had inside information directly from Warren. That one and Roger Lowenstein's book on Warren. I like that one. And Alive is a non-financial book. That was about the crash of a rugby team in the Andes and how they were in the Andes for like 72 days and two guys went off and for like 10 days trudged along in the snow and the mountains, and they finally got to freedom and brought people back to the flight. It's a book about persistence, not giving up, and creativity, you know, how to survive. That's had a huge impact on my life.
Well, Todd, again, this was a treat for me. I've been looking forward to this. I'm glad I read the book. This was amazing. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it, Mark.
You are listening to CFO Bookshelf, lifelong learning for financial leaders. And now back to our host, Mark Gandy.
Zaga Bulldogs.
Gonzaga. Yes, you got it. It's Gonzaga, not Gonzaga. Come on, man.
We're East Coast. We know these things. We don't know these things.
Well, we're here to help you. It's Gonzaga.
Okay, Gonzaga.
You better believe I did ask Todd how you pronounce his school's name because I hear it pronounced the other way so often, especially during sporting events. But again, Todd Finkel, thank you very much. Wherever you listen to the show, check out the link to the show notes page for additional resources. For instance, I have links or a link to a short video on Warren Buffett talking about the 5-hour meeting with Davey Davidson of Geico. It is outstanding. And speaking of Geico, I found a white paper on the history of, again, Geico, as they were so ahead of their time at the founding of that innovative insurance company. And then there is also a link to a Charlie Munger white paper on the psychology of human misjudgment. Guys, we need to call this a wrap. Thank you for listening. I'm Mark Gandy for CFO Bookshelf.